calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday. It's the first hour of our program, noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, and all similar in between. And thus, as has been for, what, going on 3 years now, the first hour of our Friday program is Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. That will change on Monday, by the way. But today, as it has been for the last year or so, 866-440-THOM. If you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com will get you there. And in the next hour, by the way, just a heads up, we're going to be having Alex Epstein from the Ayn Rand Institute on talking about India and their patent laws. It should be interesting conversation, actually an interesting debate. But right now, Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls throughout this hour. Senator Sanders, Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom. And
always
congratulations on the expansion of your program.
Well, thank you. It's really an honor, and always great to have you on the show, and look forward to continuing into the future. The budget seems to be moving through
Congress. Tom, there are a lot of issues taking place in Washington right now. In fact, I'm here in D.C. I'm usually back in Vermont on Friday, but I'm here because there's going to be a vote on Iraq tomorrow. We'll talk about that in a minute. But one issue I wanted to alert the listeners to is the budget process is going to begin very strongly in the next couple of weeks. And the issue here is that, as usual, President Bush submitted a budget to Congress which represents the interests of the wealthy and large corporations. It would extend and make complete the tax breaks that he's given to the wealthiest people in this country, and at the same time would cut back on Medicare, Medicaid, provide inadequate funding for veterans, cut back on educational programs, child care, many important programs that middle-income and working-class people need. Included in the president's budget, which did not in itself get a lot of attention, was the complete repeal of the estate tax. And I was just on the floor of the Senate the other day making the point, and I want people to hear this carefully. If the estate tax is completely repealed, all of the benefits will go to the wealthiest 0.2% of the American people. 0.2%, so 99.8% of Americans, people who need the help the most, will get no help whatsoever. Among the other beneficiaries, Tom, this is interesting, is the Walton family that owns Walmart. And do you know what their benefit will be?
No,
if the estate tax.
I do know that they were
crazy guests.
I do know that they were, for the last, 10 years or so, behind the scenes, they've been funding this effort to call it the death tax, to change
right.
the name. But, my wild and crazy guess, they'll make $1 billion.
$1 billion?
Yeah.
No, Tom, $32 billion. This is for the whole family.
Yeah, yeah.
And what, not just for one part, the whole family combined. Over $32 billion based on 2005 figures for one family. Meanwhile, the president is really trying to save money and balance the budget, and he decided over a 10-year period to cut back on Medicaid, which impacts tens of millions of families, by $28 billion. So senior citizens will have a harder time getting the health care they need. Kids will have a harder time getting the health care that they need because of cutbacks in Medicaid. We're talking about tens of millions of people being impacted, and yet one family will get more of a reduction in their taxes than the benefits accruing to tens of millions of people.
Right, and this is not a tax that's going to impoverish them. They will still have enough money that 20 generations down the road, their kids will know.
Let's figure that they probably won't end up on the welfare lines.
Yeah.
They are one of the wealthiest families in America. And I was on the floor of the House talking about them, the Mars family that makes our basic health food Snickers that we all love dearly, but nonetheless. They will be a major beneficiaries out of this. The former CEO of ExxonMobil, that fellow Lee Raymond, who received.
Lee Raymond, yeah.
Remember that? He got a $400 million.
Going away package.
Going away package from ExxonMobil. Well, he will receive a $164 million tax break. His family will, if this estate tax is repealed completely. The point is that we have to pay attention to these issues. At a time when poverty in America is increasing, we should not be cutting back on nutrition programs. We should not be cutting back on early childhood education programs, Head Start, child care, so forth and so on. At the same time as the president wants to give huge tax breaks to the very wealthiest people in this country. So I'm going to be pounding that theme that if we're interested about protecting the middle class, if we want to move us toward a more egalitarian society rather than see the gap between the very rich and the rest of us grow, this is an issue we've got to focus on.
Amen. Well said. Now, in Iraq, we are facing some tough times. Virgil Good, or Goody, I'm not sure how he
Good.
Says it, one of your contemporaries, I have a 20-second clip from him. If you don't mind, I'd
sure.
like to play it and get your response. This is his take on the very fact that you guys even want to debate whether Bush should have his surge.
I will not be supporting H. Conrad 63. The eyes of the world are upon this house. In no way do I want to aid and assist the Islamic jihadists who want the green flag of the crescent and star to wave over the capital of the United States and over the White House of this country.
I want to know what that guy's been smoking.
I mean, well, I think he is picking up, essentially, and going further than the theme that Bush and Cheney have been talking about.
But at least they're debating it in the House. You guys in the Senate haven't even
been
able
to debate it. That's right. And what that's about, and the reason I'm here on a Friday and we'll be here on a Saturday, is that hopefully we will have that debate. Obviously, in the House you can move a lot quicker. If you have a majority, you can move. Here you need 60 votes to make real things happen. And when Reid, the majority leader Reid, wanted to bring up a bill to start the debate in opposition to the president's escalation of the war, the Republicans were able to filibuster it and prevent a cloture, which meant that there would not have been a vote. So it has been pushed back, and now yesterday he called the Republicans bluff, and we'll be here voting again tomorrow trying to win a cloture vote so that we can have a debate on whether the escalation makes sense or not. Obviously, I think it doesn't. While I certainly will be voting for the language, which will be similar to what is in the House, which says that the escalation is not a good idea, we've clearly got to go beyond that. We have to use the budgetary powers of the Congress to not only stop this surge, but to bring our troops home safely as quickly as we possibly can.
I think when people hear the word cloture, most Americans have no idea what it means. Basically, correct me if I'm wrong, this just means end the parliamentary bickering or whatever, end the procedural stuff and wrap it up and let's go on and take a vote.
Exactly, so that we can proceed on the issue at hand. In other words, if 41 people want to talk about baseball or football and keep that discussion going, it's impossible to get to the real issues that we want to deal with. So what you need is 60 votes to say there's going to be a vote, there's going to be a timeline, we're going to discuss the issue at hand, in this case, Iraq. If 41% say, no, we don't want this to come to a vote, then you're never going to have a vote on that issue.
So
in the Senate, it's a very different process than in the House. In the Senate, it's harder to get real things done. It is easier to slow things up. That always works to the advantage of the minority, no matter which party is in the minority. That's the reality that we face. The hope here, and I think we're seeing it, is that the American people are saying in very clear and uncertain terms is they have zero confidence in the Bush administration. They have no interest in seeing this war escalate. They want our troops home. And that message is getting through to Congress. And you're seeing now a number of Republicans, especially those who are concerned about their political future, saying, wait a second, this is not a good idea, but we need strong grassroots support to tell the Congress to go beyond a vote that doesn't have much significance. It's a non-binding vote. And let's move into dealing with the budget so we, in fact, can end this war.
Which gets us back to the issue of it's not enough to just show up and vote every 2 years. You've got to get active.
You've got to get active. I think the American people know that this war has gone sour a long time ago. Many of us in the Congress, of course, never voted for this, opposed it from the very beginning. But we need to bring our troops home as soon as we possibly can, and that's what I'm going to fight to do.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders with us here. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment, the first hour of our show every Friday. Has been for years, hopefully will be for years. Well, Bernie will be taking your calls right after this break. Our number 1-866-440-8466. You can drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program.
I can believe there's a dream forever long. This is our country.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 21 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. Our number 1-866-440-8466, and Richard in Hendersonville, North Carolina. You are live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Bernie. Hello, Tom. God bless both of you guys. You're trying to fight the good fight, and we need you guys doing it. The question that my class and I came up with, because they're listening inside the other wall where I am, is about a possible preemptive strike in Iran. That's a major concern to all of us.
Yep.
And what they would like to know is, I mean, Iran, for just a little bit of history, is a country that actually supported us after 9/11. There were candlelight vigils inside of Iran's borders in support of the United States. But we have kind of probably...
They were part of the coalition that went into Afghanistan.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they helped us going into Afghanistan. And if we do a preemptive strike, as it seems like this president is possibly thinking about doing... We are going to help a radical leadership inside Iran to come to a greater position of power. And so the question is, what would be the political and even the potential nuclear fallout of such an event?
Well, Richard, you raise a very important question, and tell your students that they are very perceptive and right to be concerned about this issue. It would be an unmitigated disaster if Bush launched a preemptive attack against Iran. I want you to tell your students that I and other people are working hard to do everything we can to stop that. In the House, there is legislation which makes it very, very clear. And in the Senate, I have introduced legislation which makes it very clear that there will be in this country a major constitutional crisis if the president does not come to Congress for authority in terms of any attack against Iran, and that is authority that he will never get if he comes to the Congress.
What does a constitutional crisis mean, Bruno?
Well, the constitutional crisis is that this president has got to know that the president of the United States has certain powers and that the Congress has certain powers. And Congress is the constitutional vehicle by which this country goes to war, and you cannot circumvent the Congress. So if he were to circumvent the Congress on this issue, after all of the misleading in terms of getting into the war in Iraq, it would be a very, very dangerous constitutional situation.
Does that mean it could lead to something like impeachment? I think
that there would be many people who would be raising that issue at that point. As you know, right now, there are millions of Americans who think that that is a proper course of action and so forth. But if the president did that without the authority of the Congress, it would be unthinkable.
Yeah, and I interrupted you with that question. You were going to finish your point, or did you?
Well, that's the point. So the point is that this is a legitimate concern because we have a president who, in my view, is clearly reckless, is irresponsible. He's at the head of an incompetent administration, an extreme right-wing administration. And we have got to make it clear to him in unmistakable terms that he cannot do this.
Well said. Richard, in Birmingham, Alabama. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you, guys. It seems to me like in the movement to in the greening of America that local governments are really taking the lead. And I'm wondering why it's so difficult for us as a nation to set aggressive renewable energy standards like they do in Northern and Western Europe. It seems like we could blanket the Dakotas with windmills and the Mojave with solar panels. And Bernie, there's a book by Lester R. Brown, Plan B 2.0, about switching the economy to renewable energies. I don't know if you're familiar with him or not, but I'd love to send both of you a copy if you'd read it. Thank you.
Okay. Rich, the answer to your question is that is something we should be doing, and I think you're going to see a much, much, much more aggressive posture on the part of Congress than was the case last year when the Republicans were in control. To answer your question, and the reason that we have not been aggressive in trying to reverse global warming, in trying to break our dependency on fossil fuel and moving to energy efficiency, in moving to sustainable energy, is because you have a president in the White House with close ties to the oil industry, a president and administration that have barely acknowledged what all scientists, virtually all scientists who have studied the issue know, is that global warming is real, it's man-made, and if we don't address it soon, there could be calamitous impacts on our planet. So you have a president who's sitting up there with that perspective. The former chairman of the Senate Environmental Committee was a gentleman who believed that global warming is a hoax, and that's why you did not see any kind of real action. The good news now is that the chair of the Environmental Committee is now Senator Barbara Boxer of California. She and I have introduced very comprehensive global warming legislation, S-309, that would take us down to 1990 emission levels by the year 2020 and have those reduced 80% below 1990 by 2050, which has incentives and mandates to move us big time toward energy efficiency, toward sustainable energy. As I've said many times, I think there is huge potential for us in solar, in wind power, in hydrogen, and in other areas, and we can create good-paying jobs as we green America.
Well said. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls right here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Stick around. We'll be right back right after this break at the bottom of the hour. And I won't back down. Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. Got a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I'll stand my ground. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Well, actually, we fiendishly plot for things like clean elections, good schools, national health care. Yes, welcome back to the Tom Hartman radio program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, as he is the first hour of every Friday, taking your calls. Doug in Orlando, Florida, you're live with Bernie. Hey, Doug.
Hello. Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hey, Doug.
A quick question for you. I realize that our Democratic majority in the Senate is a fragile one. And I often wonder what the likelihood is of us losing that majority, potentially to, strength senators. Is it a strong one? Is it a weak one? I just wanted your opinion on that.
Well, it's obviously a very fragile majority. It's now 51 to 49. Counting the two independents, myself and Senator Lieberman. Tim Johnson is from South Dakota, is in the hospital. We think, by the way, he is recovering very, very well and might be out of the hospital within a couple of weeks. So right now it actually is a 50-49 majority, which is pretty fragile. And if you remember that it takes 60 votes to pass anything significant, that is a very slim majority.
Yeah. Brad in San Francisco, California. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom?
Yes.
Bernie. When Zbigniew Brzezinski was testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee recently, he mentioned the future false flag act of terrorism offered by the administration as a plausible scenario leading up to a nuclear strike in Iran. I wondered if you had a comment on that.
I don't know much more than I said previously, and that is, to some degree, what frightens me a bit is that what we're hearing from the Bush administration about Iran sounds a heck of a lot like what we are hearing about Iraq before we went to war there. My own view, as I said earlier, that going to war against Iran would be a disaster. It would clearly put the entire Islamic world against us. It would hurt us for decades to come. And I think the vast majority of the members of both the House and the Senate are opposed to it. And we will do everything that we can to make sure that the president does not act unilaterally.
Tony in Washington, D.C., you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Senator Sanders. Pleasure to speak with both of you. I wanted to ask you a question regarding impeachment. With all the high crimes and misdemeanors that you yourself, as well as many others, have spoken about in the Senate and House, why hasn't anyone brought that up now that the Democrats have a majority? It's a perfect opportunity in my eyes.
Well, I think the answer is that right now this country faces enormous problems. We're trying to bring our troops home from Iraq. We're trying to deal with the crisis of global warming. We're trying to protect the shrinking middle class and do something about the growing gap between the rich and the poor. As Tom mentioned a moment ago, we're trying to do something about the need for a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people. What is going on in both the House and the Senate for the first time in 6 years, for the first time since Bush has been in president, are serious investigations about what this guy has done. There is an effort now to try to hold the administration accountable, to get them to answer questions on civil liberties issues and many, many other issues. To simply go forward with impeachment would paralyze, in my view, the government. I don't think it's something that the American people want right now. And I suspect that's the reason why you're not seeing action there.
But if you have investigations and clear crimes come out, then Congress may go forward.
Well, that's right. I mean, the first thing is to find out, in fact, what went on. Many of us believe the president misled us into Iraq. We want to document that.
Right. Do the investigation first. Jack in Los Angeles, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Senator Sanders, my question kind of follows along with the same these other people are saying. I don't see any way that we are not going to invade Iran because the Senate or the Congress tells them not to. This person has shown no regard for the Constitution. And I think that he would just do it unless he's removed. He's just going to do it and say that there's no way around
it. Well, Jack, I mean, he's not going to be, you know, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of practical politics, you have 49 Republicans in the Senate. You have a strong minority in the House. I think the issue right now is to do everything that we can. And I don't quite agree with you that I think your assumption is that he is going to go to war against Iran. I'm not convinced that he is. I am very nervous about it. But I don't think it is a fait accompli, and I think that if Congress makes it very clear to him that that would be unacceptable, I think we can, in fact, stop him.
Paul in Seattle, Washington. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen. Senator Sanders, Tom, thank you for taking my question.
Sure.
It may seem a bit odd in the light of Bush's authoritarian policies in the Middle East, but the future concerns me even more than the present. You remember the fairness of the vote was in question pre-election. I believe the only reason progressives succeeded was because we overwhelmed the fix that was already in. I'm convinced that the system is still broken. Is there anything being done yet in Congress to correct the counting of the vote and the accuracy? I have heard nothing about it.
Well, I don't agree with you. I mean, I think one of the dangers, and Tom and I have talked about this a whole lot, is that sometimes people think, I get a little bit into conspiracy theory and think the game is set and so forth and so on. In fact, if you look at the last election in the Senate, the two very closest states in Montana and Virginia, very close, were won by Democrats, not Republicans. But having said that, should we be concerned about touchscreen balloting? And the answer is absolutely we should. And I think as a result of very strong grassroots activity all over this country, there is now a recognition that we should move beyond and away from touchscreen balloting. And the good news is that you have a governor now in Florida who has said that is what he is going to do in Florida. If they do it in Florida, I think you're going to see it around the rest of the country. Certainly, I think that the United States Congress should be part of that process and say, wait a minute, the bedrock of the democracy is the knowledge that every American has that when he or she casts a ballot, that that ballot is counted accurately. And if we're only 99% sure of that, that is not good enough. My own feeling is I would go back to paper ballots or other safe and secure means of voting and away from touch screens, so long as there is any question about that.
Tomas in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're on Live with Bernie Sanders. Hey, Tomas.
Yes.
You're on the air.
I have. Hello?
Hello.
Yes, sir.
You're through. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Tomas, I'm sorry. We'll move along. Eric in San Francisco. Hey, Eric.
Hey, it's me.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Tom. Bless you both. I'm calling to ask you to consider the civil rights of corporations. It seems to me that corporations have taken over our republic, and their undue influence is at the heart of what ails us as a nation. They've been able to do this largely because they're considered to have civil rights, the same rights as real people have before the courts. However, as legal fictions, they have a powerful political advantage over real citizens in that they don't die of old age and command more money people than your average Joe. Populism and pluralism will not have a secure home in this country until these inherently fascistic corporations lose their undue influence over the organs of our government. Now, I understand that legal precedent says
Eric, what's your question? Sorry, yeah, I appreciate the speech, but what's the question for Bernie?
Do corporations have civil rights? And how can we do something about that? Because
well,
they shouldn't.
Eric, the question that you ask is a very, very important question. And Tom, you wrote a book on that, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. It's called Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights. Yeah.
So, I mean, Tom could probably answer the question better than I can. But what I would simply say to Eric is you're absolutely right about corporations and their incredible wealth having enormous power over virtually everything that happens politically in this country. Obviously, they have power over what happens economically, whether or not jobs are created in America or they're created abroad, whether they invest abroad, enormous power over the media of this country and what the American people see, hear, and read. So taking on powerful special interest corporations is certainly at the top of my agenda. The quote-unquote civil rights, constitutional rights of corporations is a very profound issue. I don't think the Congress is anywhere near there yet, but your point is well taken, and it's an issue that we should discuss.
And it is being challenged. Over 100 cities in Pennsylvania now have passed laws saying that corporations don't have civil rights in their towns.
And so I think that's a great spot. That's what we need, movement at the grassroots level.
Alan in Des Moines, Iowa. You're live with Bernie Sanders. We have about 30 seconds before we have to take a break, Alan.
Well, the question I had to do with why we are, as Democrats, seemingly still interested in sort of staying the course with the current reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, called No Child Left Behind right now. And it seems that Kennedy and Miller are both bent on forward and would like to see a real difference in that law.
Alan, I agree with you. In the state of Vermont, there is a lot of concern about No Child Left Behind, and that's something we will work on. I'm on that committee.
Well said. It's 44 minutes past the hour, 45 minutes past the hour, 866-440-THOM, our telephone number, the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment, Senator Bernie Sanders with us, taking your calls right after this break.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
Welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment, the first hour of every Friday, noon to 1 Eastern Time, 9 to 10 Pacific Time, and all things in between. Senator Bernie Sanders with us taking your calls. Dan in Santa Rosa, California. You're live with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Tom and Senator Sanders. I read the Putin speech to the Munich Security Conference, and it seemed I became very concerned by this because he talked about how no nations are now in this world feel safe. They all feel the threat of being attacked, and I guess by us. And then he talked about how NATO forces had agreed to stay within Europe, and now they're on his border. And then he talked about the BRIC countries Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and their economic power. And it just seemed to me that he was laying out a case that, you know, we have to stop our adventurism, or at minimally they're going to do some form of economic retaliation to stop us. Does anybody in the Senate have any feelings or thoughts about this?
Well, I think obviously there is great concern about Bush's foreign policy in almost every respect. Adventurism is a pretty good word to describe what he has done and what he perhaps might want to do. And clearly, one of the issues that concerns, I think, not just some of us in the Senate, but virtually all Americans, is the incredible decline in terms of the respect that the United States now has throughout the entire world. Poll after poll shows that in countries from one end of this country to the other, our allies, our enemies, all of them, people now have much lower regard for the United States since Bush has been in office. And that is just a horrible thing for so many reasons. So to answer your question, yeah, there is very strong concern among many of us in the House and the Senate.
Linda in Daytona Beach, Florida, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, good afternoon. Well, it's afternoon down here anyway. What my question for Bernie Sanders, well, first of all, I happened to be watching C-SPAN when you were talking with Secretary Paulson, and I have to say thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
My husband and I actually stood up and applauded.
That's very kind of you, Linda.
It was wonderful. But here's my question. When all of these things seem to be working toward the same goal that the president has had all along with his budget towards making the wealthy wealthier, or at least making them more comfortable in their solace existence, what can we do down here? Can we do anything?
Sure you can. Sure you can. There's, you know, the budget process does not get the kind of attention that it deserves. People perceive it to be very, very complicated. How can they get involved in it? And the answer is people can and should be involved in it. The president's budget has got to be defeated. We need a budget which, among other things, rescinds the tax breaks that have been given to the wealthiest 1% so that we can adequately fund our veterans' needs, education, health care, the environment, and many other pressing issues that impact the middle class and working families. The military, the defense budget that the president has brought forth, includes a lot of weapon systems that I believe we may very well not need. They're Cold War relics. We want to cut those as well. So I think it is terribly important that people be involved in the budget process. Call up your member of Congress. Call up your United States senator and say that we've got to rescind tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires. We've got to cut back on Bush's proposals for military spending. We've got to lower the deficit, and we've got to take care of the needs of the middle class and working families, not just the wealthy and large corporations. I hope that people will be involved in that process.
David in Northampton, Massachusetts, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, yes. First of all, I'd like to thank you both for everything you do. And what I'm interested in is the privatization of the military, basically through Cheney and Rumsfeld, with the setup of Halliburton and Blackwater, and what the Senate and Congress can do about that process in terms of basically restructuring the military so that the money that is going to Halliburton and Blackwater can be put back into the military so these things aren't as expensive and can be run by the United States military. And if there is a process available that you guys can take control of the military and take it back instead of having people like Cheney controlling this private army.
Right, David, the answer to your question is you've raised a very important issue. We're not only looking at just an incredible waste of money. I think there is a study that just came out that we've wasted some $10 billion in terms of the reconstruction of Iraq, money that was wasted, money that was stolen, money that was given away on no-bid contracts. But more importantly, what we are doing is privatizing large sections of the military that, in fact, should not be privatized. And your question is, what can be done about it? Well, the United States Congress can do anything on any issue that they want. This is precisely the kind of issue that I hope and expect the Armed Forces Committee will be taking a hard look at, so that when we are appropriating money for the military, that we're not wasting huge sums of money through private contractors that could be done in a better and more cost-effective way through our own personnel.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, thanks so much, Bernie, for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
It is just so great that you're willing to take all these calls from our listeners.
My pleasure.
I so honor you. Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Good talking with you. Coming up next, a junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, Alex Epstein. He's going to tell us how India should be able to lock down pharmaceutical patents on products that save lives so they can increase, or they shouldn't be able to, they shouldn't be able to bust up patents so that the pharmaceutical companies can increase their profits. It should be an interesting conversation. That, the news of the day, and your calls right after the news here. Stick around. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 6 minutes past the hour, the place where reason is our lifestyle choice. Doctors Without Borders, actually a French group. It's called Médecins Sans Frontières, or however you say that in French, MSF. But in English, Doctors Without Borders, has launched what they call their Campaign for Access to Essential Medicine. They are backing up the Indian government. Up until 2005, the government of India did not allow the patenting of pharmaceuticals. They said, you can't do it. Anybody can make anything in this country, and anybody can compete. It's an open market. We're not going to provide corporate welfare. We're not going to protect individual corporations. And Dateline Brooklyn, Canada, 250,000 people from over 150 countries don't think a multinational drug company should seek to overturn a provision of India's patent law that permits the manufacture of low-cost, life-saving drugs for the world's poor. 80% of the 80,000 HIV/AIDS patients in Médecins Sans Frontières, the Doctors Without Borders programs, receive these generic drugs from India. Now, Novartis is going into India and saying, wait a minute, you can't let this happen anymore. In 2005, you signed the World Trade Organization, you entered the World Trade Organization, you now have to respect our patents, and the price on the these AIDS products has to go from $200 per patient per year to $15,000 per patient per year. Alex Epstein is with us with the Ayn Rand Institute, Ayn Rand, AYNRAND.org. Ayn Rand, of course, the author of The Fountainhead and many other, Atlas Shrugged, actually, the main book that produced the objectivist philosophy, which has informed the libertarians, which has informed Grover Norquist and the modern-day conservatives, although I realize, Alex, those guys have gone astray. Alan Greenspan, actually, was a member of your group. And probably still is. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me again.
You are of the opinion that if Novartis wants to have patent protection and charge $15,000 for an AIDS drug in India, that they should be absolutely permitted to do so. Why?
Well, I wouldn't put the question that way because neither I nor anyone else from the Institute even commented on this specific thing. But what I'm absolutely willing to say is that patent protection is a vital part of a free, civilized, wealthy, successful society. These pharmaceutical companies are creating life-saving drugs that take a lot of investment, a lot of risk, a lot of effort, and if they create a new drug, if they bring it into existence, if it hadn't been for them, the person in question, any potential beneficiaries, they wouldn't even have the chance of having their life saved. So this is a really vital thing. They absolutely deserve maximal patent protection. And so in the case of Novartis here, there's some question of, are they really creating something new? And I'm not a lawyer or a legal scholar, so I'm not going to comment on that. But what I am going to comment on is that this vital phenomenon of patent protection, which is making it possible for people in all of these countries to have much longer lives than they would otherwise have, is under attack. And I think it's unfortunately under attack by you on this show. You described it as corporate welfare, which I think is so.
Well,
are you coming out for the abolition of patents, of pharmaceutical patents?
Of scaling back, yeah.
No. I mean, what does scaling back mean? I mean, what's the principle? If it's corporate welfare, then I mean, it shouldn't exist. So.
Thomas Jefferson suggested that a patent should, and a trademark for that matter, should not exist for more than 3 years. That was a long enough time for a company to recover their investment. They can continue to make a profit after that. Let them then compete in the open marketplace.
Okay. Well, in the current lack of protection of pharmaceutical companies, that would bring you about one third of the way through the FDA approval process. So, presumably, that's not enough time to make a profit. I think the current standard is something like 20 years or 18.5 years, and that would be fine except for the fact that the FDA approval process takes about half of that. And so they should start it after the drug is actually approved. And so what you have is pharmaceutical companies who've invested all of this money are put in the position of having insufficient time to recover their investment. Their property is not being properly protected.
But Alex, patents are just the rules of the game of business. We the people get together and we define what the rules of the game of business are going to be. And as you well know, the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of the pharmaceuticals that are developed in the United States are not developed by the drug companies. The research is done by research that is funded through the National Institutes of Health with your tax dollars in mind. The vast majority of the basic research and even the core and specific research, the drug companies, by and large, most of their specific research has to do with changing a few molecules here and there so that they can extend the patent and jack up their profits on a particular product for another few years. But really what we're talking about is just the rules of the game of business. And why would you arbitrarily support a particular set of rules of the game of business that have been changed at least 30 or 40 times since this country was founded? But in large part because over the last 30 or 40 years, because of lobbying by big corporations, as opposed to, you know, I thought you were in favor of the free market. Why not just say, hey, if you make a good product, just like somebody who makes a knife or somebody who makes a motorcycle or somebody who makes a car, if you make a good product, you get to compete with other people who make good products. May the best product win.
All right. Well, that raises a good issue. So you're implying that patents and intellectual property is an illegitimate phenomenon, and I'm going to argue that that's exactly untrue, that it's a completely legitimate phenomenon, as it's absolutely necessary. So you refer to this as rules of the game, as if we're just arbitrarily making this construct that allows somebody to exclusively
produce a drug. Well, it is. It's an abstraction.
No, but it's a different form of property, but they have brought something into existence. It's the whole product is intellectual. It's
what if
coming
Ford
up, well, hold
said,
on,
said
on,
no, no, no.
Tom, I let you talk, I
right.
let you talk for
right,
a while.
Go for it, Alex.
Okay, thank you. So they are coming up with this new product. This, you know, collection of molecules, you're just modifying a few molecules. I think that's unbelievably demeaning and unfair. But in any case, they are coming up with a new intellectual product that saves lives. So this
it's
is
a physical product, Alex.
Okay, but physical is
the,
not.
The,
is
what
not
you're
the
suggesting
only
is that Henry
other
Ford
people,
should be
people,
able to say.
What you call a free market means that
you're
if
filibustering, Alex.
Brand new into the market. And I want to produce it, that you are allowed to go steal that information, and you are allowed
Alex,
to produce it all.
Alex, you know, I'll give you the, let's not interrupt each other, but let's not filibuster each other either, okay? You know, a 4-minute speech is enough. What you're suggesting is that the Ford Motor Company should be able to say, Henry Ford invented the modern assembly line and the modern automobile, therefore, General Motors can't make cars anymore. Or if they do, they have to pay a fee to Henry Ford.
Right, so there's a question of how long should the intellectual property be protected? This is an issue that's a real issue because you want
to... No, I mean, why should it apply to drugs and not to autos?
No, I'm not saying that, but you said forever. No, the person who invents the automobile, which is not Henry Ford at all, but in any case, if he invents the automobile or a patentable process, he should have it for a certain amount of time. But what happens is it's possible for other people to invent things or invent new improvements on things. And so it has to have a finite life because you want to protect the right of the individual inventor and you need to protect the right of other people to use their free mind to think of other things. And so this
I'm not
why
disagreing with that, but we're talking about products that save people's lives. Shouldn't there be a
shouldn't
different
Shouldn't we appreciate
standard?
Those more? Shouldn't we those be? Shouldn't we revere the creators? And
this is the most profitable industry on earth. Well, it was until the oil industry over the last 2 years. Up until the last 2 years, the pharmaceutical industry was the most profitable industry on earth. They don't need our help.
Well, some of these companies don't do well at all at any given period. What do you mean they don't need our help? They need to have their rights protected. I mean, Google makes a lot more profit than pharmaceutical companies. It's the fact that they make a profit just proves that they produce a really, really valuable product.
These are rights
product.
That we're creating. These are abstractions. We at law created the idea of patent. No, murder is murder in every society on earth. But if you drop into an Aboriginal society in the middle of Brazil and try to talk to them about patent law, they're gonna look at you like you just came from Mars.
And I think that's a great indication of, because it's an advanced form of recognizing that property is fundamentally about you bringing value into existence with your mind. And because they don't accept that in more primitive countries, and they don't respect the mind in general or the rights of individuals, they're completely primitive and much poorer. So
but the real world consequence of this, Alex, is that India is now no longer, because they signed the World Trade Organization agreement, and this, by the way, had been working for a long time. India is no longer going to be able to make these generic pharmaceuticals, $200 a year to treat an AIDS patient, and so Novartis is going to say, now you've got to buy them from us, $15,000 a year. How does that serve anybody?
So Novartis's goal is to make the most profit possible. And so there is a case where they bring out this product and the potential recipients of it do not have enough money. And so they have a lot of different options. They can ask for charity, and these companies are very, very generous with that. And these people, wonderful people like you who are so concerned about them, can donate money to pay for them. But,
so it all gets down to let's just depend on the rich.
The point is that there's a real threat to patent protection because India is producing generic pharmaceuticals and spreading them around the world, and so they are spreading their theft to people in America and preventing, ultimately, it's a threat to these companies' ability to make money on their own property, which is a scandal.
Okay. You had the last word. Alex Epstein, the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. If you want to read all about it, there's a piece over there that I believe... Was it Yarn Road? Yeah. Alex, thanks for being with us today.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour.
You got a headache. Now I've got some strange disease. Don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Pretinatorivox. It's made by Squab Merle Co. It's a life-enhancing miracle. But there are some things you should know.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations, but it's worth it for the drugs I need.
Ah, yes, the wonders of the pharmaceutical industry. Welcome back. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group up by and for we the people of the United States and the world. Without strong patent protection rights, so goes the argument. This is what Novartis is arguing in India. Companies will have little incentive for making investments into the discovery of life-saving drugs. On the other hand, Amit Sen Gupta, co-convener of the People's Health Movement, a global coalition of health activists now based in Cairo, says here in India, the People's Health Movement fought hard to make sure our government implemented a law that put people's health before patents and profits. But now Novartis is trying to force a change in our patent law, which could deprive people suffering from life-threatening diseases and conditions. Leading medical journals such as The Lancet, global health organizations, and officials in many countries have all asked Novartis to drop the case. MSF, Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, has launched a petition that now has nearly 250,000 people in over 150 countries expressing their concern about the impact of the Novartis case on access to medicines in developing countries. Novartis was one of the 39 companies that took the South African government to court 5 years ago in an effort to overturn that country's medicine acts that was designed to bring drug prices down. And anyhow, it goes on. I think that this is an issue that we need to have some serious discussion about. Trademark law as well. You know, how long do we stretch these things out? And it really all gets into this whole larger issue of it's all about the money. Right? I mean, the conservatives love to talk about guns, gays, and God because it obscures the real conservative agenda, which is it's all about the money. It's all about the power. And I want to get into that in some small detail. But, for example, in the Wall Street Journal here, Scott Paltrow writing, a congressional investigation into waste in Iraqi reconstruction work by U.S. contractors. Now, what does this have to do with patents and in India and the drug guy? It's all about the money. You have to get that. A congressional investigation into waste in Iraq reconstruction work by U.S. contractors threatens to mushroom into a wider inquiry into Pentagon contracting practices in general. Uh-oh. Better have a war. We can't have this kind of, you know, it's, we need a distraction, says the Bush administration. Defense Contract Agency Audit Chief William Reed confirmed that unsupported and questionable costs found in Iraqi reconstruction contracting total more than $10 billion, nearly three times the previous public estimate. Now, I don't know about where you live, but I can tell you that here in Oregon, if somebody were to have embezzled, may not be the right word, but by fraudulent means, somehow obtained $10 billion from the state of Oregon to the city of Portland, all hell would have been raised, and that person would find their butt in jail in a second. David Walker, head of the Government Accountability Office, Congress's audit agency, said lax contracting practices in Iraq are, quote, now this, by the way, the Government Accountability Office is not a partisan organization. This is, these are the green eye shade bureaucrats who are there regardless of who's in power. He says, lax contracting practices in Iraq are merely the tip of the iceberg. This $10 billion, it's the tip of the iceberg. Scott Paltrow in yesterday's Wall Street Journal says, in recent years, increasing amounts of military work have been let out to private contractors, and the percentage of no-bid contracts, those awarded with no competition, has risen. Until now, Congress hasn't focused in depth on the problem, while many members of Congress have been criticized for awarding earmarks that funnel defense contracts to particular favored companies. You get it? It's all about the money, ultimately. All about the money. And speaking of the pharmaceutical companies, here another story from the Wall Street Journal. Merck, the big drug manufacturer, $2.3 billion. Merck and company will pay the federal government $2.3 billion to resolve a decade of disputed back taxes. Now, how did this come about? This is a company that, you know, I mean, in theory, they're all about saving our lives with drugs, right? But what did? They set up a Bermuda-based subsidiary with a unit of the British bank Abbey National PLC. I'm quoting from an article by Jesse Drucker in the Wall Street Journal, to which it transferred two lucrative patents for its cholesterol-lowering drugs Zocor and Mevacor. Merck then paid the subsidiary to use those patents. The payment stream allowed Merck to allocate taxable income to Abbey within the partnership while not comparably reducing the income it reported to shareholders under accounting rules. Because of differences between U.S. and U.K. tax laws, Abbey never had to pay any taxes on most of that income either, effectively permitting it to disappear between the different tax jurisdictions. Isn't that sweet? This is like what Halliburton did with Kellogg, Brown, and Root. Let's reincorporate in the Cayman Islands so that we don't have to pay taxes on all the money that the American government is giving us to now serve, you know, at what cost, 10, 20, 30, whatever it is, dollars per meal to serve GIs instead of having GIs peeling potatoes like they used to do in the old days. Well, at least Merck is being held to account on this. But there are a few others. GlaxoSmithKline, another scam. Maybe it's not a scam. Another deal like this, $3.4 billion. There's a bunch of them out there. The drug companies making out like bandits. We'll be back with your calls and thoughts on the issue. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-440-8466. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio. And welcome back. Fair and slightly unbalanced. Tom Harbin here with listener-supported radio. Indeed, our program is listener-supported radio. It's supported by you, our listeners, listening carefully, particularly for your local advertisers on your local affiliates. That's where the rubber meets the road. Your local affiliates need all the help that you can provide them, and that's by letting your local advertisers know that you're listening, that you're buying their products, and telling your friends about them, as well as our national advertisers like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, all fair trade, all organic. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods, smalldog.com. The Organic Wine Company, 1-888 Eco Wine, and Purina One Natural Blends that my cat Higgins, our crazed cat Higgins, loves. 866-380-MEOW for Purita One. Anyway, welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Prez in San Francisco, California. Hey, Prez, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
just great, but I'll get better.
Okay, good. I had a couple points. I'm a nurse. I give out medication. And I wanted to mention one thing that I don't know if it's already been mentioned this morning. I kind of tuned in late today. But the patents and the research that goes into these drugs,
right,
that is not done by some altruistic employee at the Pfizer. Most of it's done by public universities, funded by public taxpayer money. And we hand these patents over to the drug companies.
Yeah, my point exactly. And then they change a molecule here or there from year to year to maintain the patents and
exactly.
well said, Press. James, and thanks for the call. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James.
Hi, Tom. How's everything?
Just fine. What's up?
Thank you. Well, 2 points. One, to piggyback on the last question, because I was online trying to research it. Is there any numbers exactly what percentage of this research is government funded?
Not that I've been able to find that are definitive. There, I find them all over the map. The pharmaceutical companies.
I just did a Google search. I'm sorry. And
The problem is that it depends on how you define research. If you're talking about core research to develop a brand new drug, probably a very very high percentage of that is publicly funded. If you're defining research, however, as taking a drug and changing one molecule so that you can call it a new drug, or making it 5% more effective so you can call it a new drug, then the vast majority of that's done by the pharmaceutical companies. And so everybody has their own numbers for their own talking points.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. May I just add one more point?
Sure.
I'm a little disappointed that Satellite XM isn't carrying you, and a number of us have been writing them and sort of trying to.
Yeah, James, I'm sorry. I'm going to I just don't talk about inside radio stuff on the radio. I appreciate your passion and your concern and your call, but it's not a good idea. Phil in Sherman Oaks, California. Hey, Phil, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I just love the show. It's great listening to somebody that's so educated. It's like being in a college classroom with a great teacher. I don't always agree with the conclusions, and I'm a software developer. I've been doing this for 30, 35 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I strongly believe in intellectual property protection because...
Well, I'm an author. I do, too.
For scientists and for creators and for musicians, etc., we have work that's very easily stolen. And then you have the reverse engineering issue where you spend all this time and energy, in my case, writing a computer program, and then someone can look at that program and make a similar program operate the same way in about a tenth the time. So it really saps out the motivation to do something if you can't be protected from that kind of theft.
Well, I'm not opposed to intellectual property protection. What I'm saying is that we've gone way too far. I mean, Bill Gates sitting on $45 billion or whatever, shouldn't there have been a limit? Shouldn't there have been a point at which we said, okay, that's fine, after the first few billion, now it's in the public domain, Charlie?
That's the area where the one area where I find myself disagreeing with you of all the stuff that you say is putting limits on capitalism, because then you have somebody putting that limit. Who and what is that limit? And
we the people collectively.
Why should there be any limit at all on how much money somebody could make?
Because we're not talking about capitalism here. What we're talking about here is government protection of particular industries and businesses. That's what patent and trademark laws are. Originally, Jefferson argued that there should be none whatsoever. He thought the market should be completely open. If you want a free market, then you have no patent or trademark protections.
Correct.
So really what you're talking about is massive interference in the free market by government using the force of law and the court system to enforce it.
Yeah, because it's so easily stolen. That's why the protection is there, and that's why the protection is needed. Now, it becomes interesting with the pharmaceutical industry, and I guess what would motivate me for either side of the argument would be what's going to produce more and better drugs, letting them do whatever they want and providing them with as much protection as possible, or providing them with little protection and letting them just play pure market forces. What's going to get the best, the most drugs?
Yeah, and I think the jury's out on that, but 20, 30 years ago, 40, 50 years ago, they didn't have anything close to the kind of patent protection that they have now, and they were still developing pharmaceuticals aggressively, and they were still making money, and the companies were growing, so I just, the same thing with trademark law, for that matter, frankly.
Well, you're right about the patents. I mean, they are handing out a lot more. It's still just 17 years. It's been 17 years for a very long time. But they
right, but the ability to renew it with just the slightest change is a gaming of the system that has largely came about since the first Bush administration.
Yeah. Oh, well, anyway, thanks, and I absolutely love your show.
Sure. Thank you very much, Phil.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Karen in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Karen.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
I'm good. I wanted to make a comment about the guy from Ayn Rand who wants people like you to use their dollars to help out people who can't afford these ridiculous drug prices. And
I think if you think people like me, if you think I'm the people who are millionaires and billionaires, let
well,
me
that's what he said.
Disappoint you.
That's what he said. He said people like you. But I think that we can make a little bit of difference here just by finding out who makes the drugs that we all take every morning for non-life-threatening conditions. And get a generic for those Novartis drugs.
Yeah.
Ask for a recommendation for a different type of
pill. But the problem comes when there isn't a generic available. And what India has been doing is they've been saying, you know, if there's a drug out there, then we're not going to respect international patent rights.
Exactly.
And we're going to allow the generics to be made here in India. And for a long time, the pharmaceutical companies in the West were sufficiently profitable that it didn't matter to them if, you know, poor people were getting the drugs cheap from Indian pharmaceuticals. This was a decision that the Indian Parliament, the largest democracy in America, made. And then in 2005, when they signed the World Trade Organization Agreement, the drug company said, ha-ha, we've got you now. And,
exactly. And there's a moral component here that's wrong, and those of us who have insurance and money could speak with our dollars in a small way, but at least
In a small way, yeah. But be very careful with that logic, Karen. I agree with you, and I try to make, you know, purchasing decisions right across the board in ways that are morally and ethically appropriate. And when we start buying into the conservative rhetoric about vote with your dollars, then you end up in a world where the people with the most dollars win. That's not democracy.
I don't feel like it's voting with my dollars. I feel like it's speaking with my dollars.
Good. Okay. Then, yeah, got it. And well said. Thank you very much, Karen.
Thank you.
Rico in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Rico, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Hey, great show today, too, by
Thank
the way.
Thank you.
A couple things on my mind. I think the first thing is, as far as the guy from the Ayn Rand study, and I'm sorry, his name totally slips my mind now. But
Alex Epstein.
After listening to Mr. Epstein talk, the thing that got me the most, and this is just my gut feeling, there's no empirical proof, there's no scientific, evaluation. My gut feeling is this, though. He talks a lot about, how enlightened societies do this and that and the other thing, and, that shows how advanced we are. You know what? In an advanced society, you don't let your neighbor die of some kind of disease.
Yeah, and in fact, in primitive societies, people look out for each other.
Yeah, I mean,
quote-unquote primitive.
Yeah, I mean, that was the implication. I'm like, you know what? I think the most advanced thing that we could do is help our neighbors. And it seems ridiculous that, it's the same thing with us not having nationalized, some form of nationalized health care that's effective and efficient. Like, these are things that I feel if we're the leading nation in the world, if that's, what's really important about being American, I mean, that's helping your neighbor. That's patriotic. That's civic duty.
Yeah.
And
I would add that's also at the core of the foundational core of Judaism and Christianity. I mean, if religion for that matter. I mean, if you want to talk about moral values and family values and everything else. Rico, well said. Very well said. Thank you very much for the call. Terry in Louisville, Colorado. Hey, Terry.
Good morning. I've spent over 20 years in pharmaceutical business, and there's a couple points I thought you might want to consider.
Sure.
One thing is that I spent over a decade in R&D working in a pilot plant as an operator.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were seeing over the years is that about one out of every 11 compounds that we worked on made it to the market.
Sure.
That's a pretty high failure rate.
Yeah.
So there are millions of dollars you're investing in failure. And I think that argues well for patent rights. But there is so little transparency in the business that, for instance, one of the drugs we worked on was for genital herpes. And it was a nasty drug. It was unpleasant to make. It was dangerous to work around. And it wasn't looking very good. We bought the patent rights from Burroughs Wellcome, who had developed AZT.
We just have a half a minute, by the way, Terry. I'm sorry.
Okay. Long story short, this genital herpes drug turned out to be good for CMV, cytomegalovirus, which is something that AIDS patients have a real problem with.
Sure.
And overnight, it was a multi-million-dollar product for us. Mm. And, there was no extra research involved in that. It was just a windfall.
Yeah, I don't think any of us are suggesting the pharmaceutical company shouldn't be able to make a profit, you know, or even that their CEO shouldn't make multi-hundred-million-dollar salaries like they do. It's just that there should be some kind of limit on it, don't you think?
Absolutely, and the real thing is that when clinical trials are expensive like that, there is no standard format for how the trials are set up and run.
Yeah. Terry, I've got to wrap it up at that. I'm sorry. Thank you for the call, though. 45 minutes past the hour.
Listen to the radio, see it on the TV, headlines in the morning paper, the clock of history repeats. They say we gotta make a stand, shoot 'em till they drop, lay a little freedom there, like it or not. If I told you once, must have told you twice. The last thing you're looking for is their advice.
Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney, thank you very much, no thanks. Welcome back. It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix, the Tom Hartman radio program. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, accredited White House reporters in Washington, D.C., on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in Washington, D.C. today?
Well, we've got a fairly ticked-off Senate, because they were hoping to go home for President's Week. They don't get to.
Well, some of them are actually enthusiastic about it. Some of them are actually enthusiastic about it. We were talking Bernie Sanders earlier, and he's like, oh, boy, you know, we get to stay here and vote.
He's a maverick.
Yeah, he is.
He's a maverick. He likes working. But we got a whole lot of presidential candidates who had plans, you know, and speeches to give and rallies to attend. But basically they will be voting. An up-and-down vote is my understanding on what is essentially the House's resolution. They decided that Harry Reid decided that the resolution that was pretty convoluted and lengthy that they had before is not the way to go. Let's do a really simple, easy one, and let's see where we get with that. Well, they may well get nowhere with this. Possible they get nowhere with this.
Why? You have at least a couple of Republicans who are opposed to the surge, and you have probably 49 Democrats. Joe Lieberman probably wouldn't vote for this, but you add 49 Democrats to a half a dozen Republicans, and you have a majority.
If the Republicans really do come through, then you do. If they really
you don't think
do
that,
come through.
You don't think that Susan Collins or Chuck Hagel or some of the folks who have been speaking, Gordon Smith, for example, you know, the local paper says that he's going to vote in favor of a resolution like this. I'm not sure if it's true or not, but, you know.
Well, this is the question. I mean, there's an awful lot of pressure from the White House. There's horses' heads appearing on people's pillows all over the place.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Metaphorically speaking.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Meanwhile, over on the House side, they're finishing up debate. They're nearly done. Everybody got their 5 minutes worth of fame. And a lot of it was pretty much schoolyard stuff, you know, my resolution is better than your non-resolution. But they have finished nearly, and then they're going to vote late this afternoon or early this evening, and it will pass. There may be two or three Democrats who go to the other side, but there will certainly be Republicans going to the Democrat side. They don't need them. But they will be going over to the Democratic side, and this will pass. This non-binding resolution will pass, which, you know, there have been Republicans saying in Voices of Doom, this is just the beginning. But the fact of the matter is, they're right. This is just the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And the next step. Now, we talked yesterday about whether or not Congress would be out all next week or whether they would be coming back. Is the fact that Harry Reid looks like he's been successful in pulling off an up or down vote in the Senate tomorrow, even though it's a Saturday, is that going to give them that week?
I think that'll give them the week. I don't think they're going to come back.
Yeah, okay.
I think they'll be gone. And then we see Representative John Mercer really come into his own on the House side as the various moves that he has planned once they start to discuss the money come into play, things such as, some sound so obvious, such as you have to have a year's rest in between deployments in Iraq.
The problem is, though, if you have a year's rest in between deployments in Iraq, we don't have enough soldiers for the current levels of troops.
maybe he thought about that when he was coming up with the idea.
Yeah. Nancy Pelosi, I understand, is going to suggest, I mean, Bush, that for example, if Bush is going to have his money for his surge, then he's going to have to use that money for body armor and actually supporting the troops, as opposed to, you know, possibly prepositioning troops for an invasion of Iran or something like that, there's a whole lot of holes in Bush's plan. What's the buzz on that?
Well, the buzz on that is whether that is micromanaging or not. There's no question but that Congress can end the war, whether they have the guts to or not. That's other people's words, not mine. But whether what Pelosi is suggesting is really micromanaging the war, that's what I think may come to be the constitutional issue.
Yeah. And who decides that?
Ultimately, I imagine it would be the courts.
So are you suggesting that if Congress passes a law that says that Bush may have, you know, $80 billion, but he has to use $2 billion of it to buy body armor, that's something that Bush would push back and say, no, I'm not going to do that, and Congress would then sue and it would end up in the Supreme Court?
I suppose it could go down that way. On the other hand, he could just not sign it.
Mm-hmm. But then he doesn't get the money. Yeah. And then he blames the Democrats and says, you guys aren't supporting the troops, and, you know, and we're back to Virgil Goody saying that the green star and crescent is going to fly over the White House.
Exactly. Right. Or he signs it and issues a signing statement.
Yeah, which is, you know, and any word, by the way, speaking of signing statements, I know that there are 52 different investigations going on by the Democrats into Republican dirty tricks and crimes right now. Any of them have to do with signing statements?
Not that I have heard.
That would be a good question. And also, was there a follow-up? Has there been any follow-up to yesterday's question of Bush? Did you, sir, authorize the leaking of Valerie Plame's name?
Not yet, no.
But has there been a press conference? There hasn't been a press conference since then.
There hasn't been a press conference yet. It's probably going on even as we... But actually, it's just finished.
Yeah, okay, great. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Victoria, for the report.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of the news of the day and continuing to take your phone calls right after the news at the top of the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain! Just don't tell Limbaugh, he'll want some.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. After years of putting up with a patchy, overburdened rail network, guess who is suddenly shoveling billions of dollars into new tracks and high-speed trains? This is an article in today's Wall Street Journal by Bruce Stanley. Beijing has embarked on a 5-year plan through 2010 that calls for a near quadrupling of investment. Now, I want you to notice that word. A quadrupling of investment to modernize the country's railways, which it sees as a foundation of a prosperous economy. China right now is the fastest growing market for both passenger trains and those carrying freight. But let me get back to investment. In the United States, we understood, whether it was doing research that would ultimately lead to developing pharmaceuticals, as several callers have pointed out, so much of the core research that's done for pharmaceuticals is paid for by the National Institutes of Health, by you and me. Whether it's developing new drugs or whether it's coming up with new products or whether, actually, mostly in the public sector, we had this notion The things that have to do with we the people, the things that have to do with the commons, those things that, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the statements from the Declaration of Independence, or the preamble to the Constitution, I mean, you know, it really laid it out and laid it out well, and just very clearly. In order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. We the people are going to do this, okay? So how did we do? We defined the commons. We said there is part of the stuff among all of us that we're not going to just hand off to one person or one company or one institution. We are going to collectively hold it through our and administer it through our elected representatives and people working for them under our direction, we the people. And that stuff is referred to as the commons. Our public road system, our rail system, the air we breathe. In most communities, the water we drink. In many communities in the United States, the electricity that we use. Our sewage systems, our rivers, our waterways, our lakes, our shorelines, our coastlines, our national parks, our forests, our police departments, our fire departments, our public schools. These are collectively the commons and the things that we all share in common. And we really, frankly, don't want anybody profiting off them, because the goal of them is to provide for the common good, the common defense, the general, promote the general welfare, to provide for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They're the things that are essential to our basic living, government backstopping us. And for 200 years in this country, we understood that when we invest in the commons, there will be a return, a social return, frankly, as well as a financial return. You put $5 million into building a school, you're going to get $500 million back over the next 30 years, the lifetime of that school, as those people who are educated go out into the workforce, earn a living, and pay taxes. You put $20 million into building a road, you're going to generate commerce that's going to generate billions of dollars, which is going to generate hundreds of millions of dollars in taxes that's going to more than pay back that road. We have understood that when we built dams or when we built roads or when we put in the air traffic system or when we had railroad systems, they built Amtrak, that when we invested in the commons, that we were doing it for us. And then came Ronald Reagan. And then came this conservative worldview associated with Ronald Reagan that said basically, no. Government is evil. Government is terrible. Government is a bad thing. Government is a them. Now, I'm not sure where they got this idea. I know Ayn Rand got the idea from growing up in Russia. She grew up in Russia. She was 7-8 years old during the Bolshevik Revolution. Her father owned a pharmacy. He lost his business when it was nationalized. She was horrified by that. She went to school in Kiev, the University of Kiev, a Soviet school, communist school, and she learned that there were basically two systems, communism and capitalism, and came back and wrote Atlas Shrugged and other things, and this has become the anthem. It's communism or capitalism. Well, I'm sorry, it's communism or democracy. Democracy in a republic, in a constitutionally limited representative republic. But Reagan somehow was buying into this libertarian notion, this objectivist notion. The libertarians, I call them Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid, right? I mean, they say, oh yeah, drugs and prostitution should be perfectly legal, and the robber baron should run the country. They think that economics and politics are the same thing. They're not. They're separate. Capitalism is an economic system. Democracy is a political system. So Reagan comes along and he starts trashing government.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And a lot of people bought into that. And the whole idea of government being an investment, that when government spent money on infrastructure, it was an investment, has pretty much evaporated from our vocabulary as a result of this 26-year assault by the conservative meme makers, by the $3 billion at least spent on conservative think tanks to cause us to think that all government spending is an expense, that taxes are a burden, that they're not the cost of civil society, the price of admission to civil society. And China, here we have a dictatorship. And yet when we refer to their building their infrastructure, the Wall Street Journal refers to it as an investment. Beijing has embarked on a five-year plan through 2010 that calls for a near quadrupling of investment to modernize the country's railroads, which it sees as a foundation of a prosperous economy. By 2010, they're going to add 10,540 miles of new track. They're going to dedicate 4,340 miles of new track solely to high-speed passenger trains, some with top speeds exceeding 200 miles an hour. They're upgrading 8,000 miles of existing track. They're electrifying 9,300 miles of track to accommodate electric as well as diesel trains. They're more efficient, less polluting. They're going to increase the maximum speed of freight trains on all their lines to 75 miles an hour. We've got none of this. Our rail system is falling apart. Amtrak is struggling to exist. And the Chinese are saying, yeah, we know what it takes to build a nation. We watched you guys do it for 200 years. And now that the conservatives are taking your country apart, we're going to put ours together. This is such a tragedy. Not that China's doing this. I mean, you know, that's not the tragedy. The tragedy is that we are, we're just handing, we're just walking away from this here in the United States. Nigel Rayner, a transportation specialist at the Asian Development Bank, he says, the scale of China's planned railway expansion is unprecedented. The Asian Development Bank has lent the Chinese government $2.94 billion for railway improvements since 1989. That's what, a day and a half in Iraq? Last year, Siemens booked an order for 60. This is a German company. They make high-speed trains. For 60 high-speed trains valued at $878.3 million. Alstom Transportation, this is a French company, and a consortium led by Japan's Kawasaki Heavy Industries Limited, each won identical orders for 60 bullet trains, while Germany's Bombardier sold 40. Or is Bombardier French? I'm not sure. It's one or the other. You'll notice there were no American companies listed there. Because our notion of global free trade, you know, we don't protect our domestic industries anymore. We say, hey, if they can make it cheaper over there with slave labor, or they can make it cheaper over there with government subsidies, or they can make it cheaper over there, period, we're not going to support our companies. And here's the kicker. Foreign manufacturers that win rail-related contracts face demands to transfer technologies to Chinese joint venture partners as a quid pro quo for the profits they stand to earn in China. For example, Siemens, a German conglomerate, has agreed to build 57 of its 60 trains at a local factory in China. So we say to the German companies, that's fine, we'll just buy your product. China says to them, we'll buy your product, but you've got to come to China and make it here. And by the way, when you're done, we want the technology so that we can start a company that'll make it here so we can kick you out. These guys are really smart. Why do we have such a stupid foreign policy and trade policy? 866-440-8466, 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. What gives you the right for you to stand there and tell me what to do? Tell me, you have the power to stop me from living like I do. Remember, and welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour, talking back to the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Here's some good news, I guess, from the Wall Street Journal also. This from an article by Greg Hitt in today's paper. Leading House Democrats, this is the flip side of the story. Well, actually, it's not even the flip side of the story, because the story that I was just sharing with you about China upgrading their rail system was about, you know, a government doing something intelligent, even though it's a, you know, a criminal dictatorship. Leading House Democrats, after pulling the Bush administration behind the idea of incorporating labor rights into trade deals, are upping the ante further in the trade debate by pushing the White House to take a tougher line toward China. There's a hearing today in the House Ways and Means Committee. It's expected to lay the groundwork for action on legislation that would bring China under U.S. laws that use tariffs to punish companies that unfairly subsidize their exports. The Bush administration obviously freaking out. Sander Levin, the Michigan Democrat, chairman of the House Ways and Means Trade Subcommittee, he says what the administration needs to accept is there's a new majority and there's a need for new policies. Amen. See, yes, we want to have free trade so that we can all, I mean, go back to Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations, you know, 1776. The basic premise is, it's been 30 years since I read it, but my recollection is that the example that Smith used was some variation on something very close to this, which is, if you have three countries, and one, because of their natural geography and the people living there, they produce excellent wool, you know, sweaters. They've got land that's well-suited to sheep. Another one that makes great wine, and another one that's got a lot of cows, and they make great cheese. Wouldn't it be great if these three countries could trade so everybody can, you know, wear a sweater, have some cheese while they're drinking their wine? Yes. But what happens when all three countries can make the cheese? Then it becomes incumbent on each country to figure out a way to try to protect at some level their domestic cheese production. And so in 1787, Tench Cox, an American businessman, he was the first, you'd argue, he started the American Chamber of Commerce in a way. I mean, it was sort of called that back then. He was never a political figure, but he was friends to all the founders and the framers of the Constitution. And he lobbied for the first tariff law to specifically protect American industries, where we said, okay, you know, that's great. If you want to make a pair of shoes in Malaysia where it's cheaper, if there's a dollar's worth of labor and a pair of shoes made in the United States and you want to make them in Malaysia where there's 10 cents worth of labor, that's fine. We can't stop you from doing that. This is a free world, free country. But when you import those shoes, we're going to charge a 90-cent tax on each pair so that it costs you a dollar in terms of labor or labor plus tax, that import tax called a tariff, no matter what. Now, do you want to make the shoes in Malaysia for 10 cents plus a 90-cent tax, or do you want to make them in Connecticut for a buck? Your choice. And companies said, I'll make them in Connecticut or Alabama or New York or Louisiana or California, whatever. And we had a textile industry in the United States, and we made shoes in the United States, and we made computers in the United States, and we made railroad cars in the United States, and we made steel in the United States, and we made clothing in the United States, and we made computers in the United States, right across the board. And for 200 years, that was the basis of our trade policy. In fact, it was so much the basis of our trade policy and our industrial policy, frankly. We used to have a national industrial policy until Reagan came along. So much so that tariffs, those taxes that I was just telling you about, produced 100% of the revenue that the federal government ran on, paid the paycheck of every president from George Washington to Abraham Lincoln. 100% came from tariffs. It was the only source of revenue for the federal government. From the time of the Civil War until World War I, it was two-thirds of the source of the total revenue for the federal government. And from World War I to World War II, as the size of federal government in the United States a little more than doubled, it became about a third of the total source of revenue. Not only was it a source of revenue for us, but it also kept our industries here. It kept middle-class jobs in America. It kept America, it built our American, it built the strongest industrial power the world had ever seen. And nations all over the world are still doing this right now. If you want to build a car here in the United States and sell it to China, the Chinese charge you a 20% import tariff. If the Chinese want to sell a car here in the United States, 2% import tariff. Tell me that makes sense. What am I missing here? So I think, frankly, the Democrats need to go a whole step beyond just saying we're going to punish China with an import tariff because they're using slave labor or their labor policies are bad or whatever. We should simply go back to equalizing labor markets using tariffs. This is, you say, well, that's protectionism. Yes, it's called protecting America. Every other country in the world does it to one degree or another. Now, I realize, you know, ever since this was, by the way, the point that that crazy old coot Ross Perot with the big ears and the charts and graphs was making back during the debate with George Sr. And Bill Clinton. We still had a fair number of tariffs at that time. Well, that crazy old coot was right. not to say that I ever voted for him, but he was right. And now we've seen the consequences of it. We've seen that Thomas Friedman is wrong, and the world is not flat, unless you're a multi-billionaire. And it's time to change our policies. We'll be back with your calls right after this. 27 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harpin. Thirty-three minutes past the hour, moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Harpin here with you, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Jackie in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Jackie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I do love your show, but I was just thinking today. I mean, you just said, you know, spreading, returning democracy.
Yeah.
There's so much talking, blogging, writing. I mean, there's great books that are being written. There's, you know, we're signing petitions. But didn't someone say every 200 years we need a real revolution?
Actually, what Jefferson said was every 19 years, every generation should essentially rewrite the Constitution. He later, I think, regretted saying it. He said a lot of things before the French Revolution that like the Tree of Liberty needs to periodically to be watered by the blood of patriots. And then after the French Revolution, and it went horribly wrong, he sort of backed off on those statements. And,
Either way. Do you know what I mean, though? There's wonderful books being written. There's great minds putting, you know, saying what's wrong, and nobody's really doing anything. And
actually, I think a lot is being done, Jackie. I really do. There is a tremendous movement. You have over 300 communities in the United States now as a result, in large part of the Green Party's activities, that have adopted instant runoff voting. You have 100 communities just in the state of Pennsylvania that have passed laws saying that corporations do not have human rights in their area. In Humboldt County, California, they just passed a ballot initiative saying that corporations don't have human rights. There is a slow... slow motion, but very real revolution happening in the United States.
And we have a president who may take us into another war. I mean, how can this really be happening to us? I feel like anytime I've questioned how Germany let it happen to them, I'm wondering, we're letting it happen to us. Where are the people that would really make the change, not in slow motion any longer? Yeah.
Here, Jackie. It's you and me. I can't tell you the number of people who are starting to show up. I mean, I live in Portland, and the next county over is Washington County. And I gave the keynote speech at a fundraiser that the Democratic Party did there last fall. And there were about 400 people in the room. And Lupita, the president or whatever the title is of the head of the local Democratic Party, the county party chairman, I guess, chairwoman, I guess is the title. She said that 4 years ago, on a good night, on a good meeting night, they'd have a half a dozen people. And now they have 300 people.
I certainly think that there is changes being made, but it's a little bit slow for what's really happening. And if this president can take us into another war, then we can all be totally ashamed of ourselves, and the people who should have been our best leaders didn't do what they should have done.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, Jackie. And I think that Bernie is right that if Bush does, and thank you for the call. And I think that if Bernie is right that if Bush does try to do this, it will provoke a constitutional crisis, which is code words in the Senate for we are going to impeach your butt. And that's the direction that it's going. Marcella in Salinas, California. Hey, Marcella.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
I think pharmaceutical advertising should be banned on television. I believe this country, or maybe New Zealand, are the only countries in the world who advertise directly to consumers.
And we didn't allow it until just about 15 years ago, as I recall.
Yeah, and if you will remember, it took a long time for cigarettes to be taken off the air. And once that happened, then we started focusing, the news media started focusing on the fact that cigarettes cause cancer. Now, what I'm leading to is, if the advertisements of drugs is taken off television and off magazines, maybe Big Pharma will no longer control the media and Congress.
Yes. Yeah, there's two things. Absolutely, Marcella, well said. There's two things at work here. The first is that we, as consumers, we can't be expected to be intelligent consumers of pharmaceuticals, prescription pharmaceuticals. I mean, there's just you read the package liners that come with these things, and you get it that there really should be a physician involved in the process. So there's no reason to be advertising these things directly to us, other than to drive up profits. And profits have their place, but they shouldn't be first and foremost, in my opinion, in an industry that has to do with human life and health, number one. So I don't think that they should be allowed to be advertised on TV. And number two, consider this. Last year, during the run-up to the election, I was seeing ads on CNN for an oil rig company. I was seeing ads for a defense contractor advertising jet fighter planes. Now, tell me that anybody who's watching CNN is going to pick up a phone and dial an 800 number and buy a $40 million oil drilling platform or a $100 million fighter plane. It ain't going to happen. So why are these companies advertising? Well, because it's a convenient way to deliver hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to CNN. Now, why would they want to do that? Because CNN is not going to bite the hand that feeds them. And the same thing is happening right now with the pharmaceutical companies. When was the last time you saw any serious investigative journalism being done about the oil industry, about pharma, about the pharmaceutical industry? It just, outside of public television, it ain't happening. And increasingly, you're seeing grants from these industries going into public broadcasting as well, and it ain't happening. Bill in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Congratulations on your new expanded audience on Monday.
Well, thank you, Bill. I'm looking forward to it.
I know you'll wow them. Listen, I wanted to bring up the fact that our most prolific inventor among our founding fathers, Ben Franklin, was against patents, against them completely.
Yes. Yeah, and in fact, he put most of the things, I believe maybe all the things that he invented, into the public domain.
Right. He never patented because he said that, obviously I'm paraphrasing, that it stopped the future development of the products and improvements on the products and the expansion of scientific thinking. So,
yes.
Was our founding father, right? One of our best.
Yep, absolutely. Ben Franklin, the guy who opened the Constitutional Convention, or one of the guys who opened the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah.
Well said, Bill.
I want to give you a personal antidote on your commons comments that you always make. I had had to go to a small claims court thing this last year in Chicago here. And, of course, small claims courts were set up for small people, right, the little people. We had to have our little hearing in the back with a retired judge because the payday loan people have all three courts tied up all day long.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the points, is that corporations in America are paying, it varies from state to state, but paying somewhere between 5 and 12% of the cost of running government and all the commons, and yet they're clearly deriving at least 50% of the benefit.
Oh, yeah.
The court systems are well more than 50%.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, so, good luck.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Dave in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I tend to agree that the big pharma should allow, it should have patents and their intellectual property protected to make a reasonable profit. But what about the American worker, the skilled semi-professional, the engineers, the scientists who went and made the investment in going to school, keeping their skills up and are selling that intellectual property? They need to be protected as well. They commoditize those skills and outsource them.
Yeah.
They're not being protected. So if you want to protect the patents on the drugs, fine. Let's protect the skill set of the American worker.
That's a great parallel. Very, very well said, Dave. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Dave and Kate at South Deerfield, Massachusetts. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for helping to educate us all every day. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm just sitting here having a good time, Kate.
Yeah, I'm glad you're having a good time because it helps me. My question for you, it's on a little different tack than what you've just been talking about, but in thinking about Bush's latest push for this surge, if the Democrats are actually successful in stopping this latest surge, if Murtha and others actually do this, how will the Democrats handle this administration then blaming the Democrats for everything that's going wrong in Iraq? Because
it's going to happen no matter what. Surge or no surge, it's going to happen no matter what. The GOP is going to blame the Democrats for their failure. Bush, I mean, right now he's trying to blame Iran. George Bush has never taken the blame for anything in his whole entire life.
Right.
Arguably when he got busted for cocaine and had to do 30 days of community service in Dallas or Houston, when he was 17 or 18. But I think that's it. You know, as far as I can tell, I mean, you know, I don't think that the Democrats should worry about that. I don't think it should even be part of their discussion, frankly. Mm-hmm. Just assume the GOP is going to do their worst. The conservatives, by and large, have a political and economic philosophy that is not embraced by the majority of Americans. And so, by and large, as Harry Truman pointed out in 46, every 2 years, they start talking like Democrats, and B, they're always throwing out issues and topics that really have nothing to do with the bedrock stuff, with the economic stuff, so that people won't pay attention to their failures.
Well, I hope we're successful in making that happen. I do.
I hope so, too.
Thanks.
I hope so, too. Thanks. Thank you, Kate. Jim in Whittier, California. Hey, Jim.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Yeah, I just wanted...
By the way, we've got to take a break in about a half a minute here, so...
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to, ask why you keep talking about truth and why you keep talking about, the founding fathers and democracy when the founding fathers despised democracy.
How so?
Well, I've got about 50 quotes here where the founding fathers, they despise it. Madison, Adams, Fisher Ames, Governor Morris, and so on.
Let me give you my response to that right after the break, Jim. But good question you raised, because there are a lot of people who are promoting that meme, and particularly Republicans who want you to say, oh, it's a republic, it's not a democracy. Democracy sounds too much like Democrat, and that sounds like the Democratic Party. 45 minutes past the hour.
I see trees of green. Red roses too, I see them blue for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Special thanks so much to my producer David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn, Lauren Kirshner at Air America in New York, to Ben and Shelby at the White Rose Society, radiopower.org, to Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks. We couldn't do it without you. Now, back to the question, Jim's question from Whittier, California. Jim, you were saying the founders hated democracy.
Right.
First of all, if you want to really dig into this and follow up on this, Ronald Dahl, who is a professor of American history someplace.
I don't have to. I have the quotes right here. I don't have to.
No. Well, let me finish my sentence here. Robert Dahl wrote a book called How Democratic is the American Constitution? And he lays out this whole fascinating story. In 1786, a year before the Constitution was written, if you had looked up in a dictionary in the United States the word democracy and the word republic, under democracy it would have said see republic, and under republic it would have said see democracy. I mean, I'm somewhat exaggerating, but the point is the words were conflated.
Is this
the
Tom?
Same thing. This is Tom, yeah.
Hey, Tom. Yeah. I actually have information here that I know for a fact that limited representative government is based on the Bible. So, I mean, not only were the founders, the founders got their rule by law from the Bible, but as it is right now, we live in an oligarchy. This isn't even a democracy. I mean,
Jim, let me just finish this point. And I don't disagree with you that there is an oligarchy here, but we're not entirely oligarchic yet. But the founders and framers, when in 1787, when they put together the Constitution, the question was, how do we sell this thing to the people? Because there were a lot of people, we were operating under the Articles of Confederation, and there were a lot of people who were very happy with that. Very, very weak federal government, frankly, very weak states. And there were a lot of, and the framers of the Constitution, Madison, Jefferson wasn't there, but he played a role from France, Franklin, Hamilton, George Mason. I mean, there's a whole series of them who were very, very active. John Hancock were very concerned that without a Constitution and some sort of clear governance, that this country could not survive. And so, James Madison, in one of the Federalist Papers, and I forget which one it was, it might have been 14, it might have been 24, it might have even been 13, I think it was either 14 or 24, he wrote in one of the Federalist Papers that there was a distinction between a democracy and a republic. And he was going back and looking in Greece, which was a pure democracy, Athens, Greece, you had to have 6,001 people to show up to pass a law. And, you know, in other words, everybody participated. Everybody had to serve as a legislator at one point or another in their life. It was like a lottery. It was like jury duty. And if you didn't show up when your name was called, you were called an idiota. That's where the word came from, idiot. On the other hand, in Rome, they had a republic. They had a representative form of government, at least initially. And so where people elected people to represent them. And so what Madison was saying was that you don't want a democracy, which would be mob rule, that you do want a republic, which is a representative government. And he made that case very strongly, separating the meaning of those two words. And as Robert Dahl points out in his book, How Democratic is the American Constitution, by the end of his life, James Madison, who wrote that Federalist paper when he was in his 30s, when he was in his late 60s, after he had been president of the United States, in several of his letters, he pointed out that he made that artificial distinction simply to sell the Constitution, and that in his mind, America was as much a democracy as a republic, that we are what is called a hybrid form of government, both a democracy and a republic. We have a democratic form of government and a republican form of government. But for a good 10, 12 years there, from 1787 until arguably around the time Jefferson became president in 1800, it was politically inappropriate to refer to America as a democracy. And that's why when Jefferson put together what is called the Democratic Party today, it was called the Democratic Republican Party. And it wasn't until the 1820s that everybody figured out that, hey, we're both. We're a democracy and a republic. Madison had come out about it when he was, you know, after his presidency. He was president from, as I recall, 1808 to, what, 1814, 12, whatever it was. And they dropped the word Republican from the name of the party, the Democratic Republican Party, the guys who first came up with that idea. So Jim, if you've got a lot of quotes from the founders, I could give you 100 more saying we're a Republican and not a democracy. Yeah, they're there. There are also a lot of quotes saying we're a democracy. But the Republican Party resurrected this back in the Newt Gingrich era to say we want the founders to be using the word republic as much as possible because it sounds like Republican, and we want the founders to be trashing the word democracy as much as possible because it sounds like Democrat.
That's not true, because the founders got all this information from the Bible. So the quotes are all right there. I've got one right here from Noah Webster. Our citizens should early understand.
Noah Webster was not
correct.
Yeah, Noah Webster was not a member of the Constitutional Convention.
Is the Bible, particularly the New Testament or the Christian religion? So the whole.
Well, there are. Brats, I just dumped Jim. Jim, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to dump you there. There are 10 commandments in the Bible. There are only 2 that are in law. You know, don't steal, don't kill. We don't have laws in the United States against worshiping the wrong God or honoring your mother and father. I mean, you know, come on. That's a whole other argument for a whole other date. I didn't realize you were going to go off in that direction. Coming up on Monday's program, I'll be challenging conservative Mark Morano, who's saying the scientific and political momentum is clearly shifting away from climate alarmists to climate realists. Say what? This guy works for James Inhofe, but he's a good guy, but it'll be an interesting conversation, I guarantee. That and your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. Have a great weekend, my friends, and remember, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.